This is the American Literature Pre-Discussion Podcast on Uncle Remus Tales. The text that we're studying is Nights with Uncle Remus, which is the second of the Joel Chandler Harris collections of African-American folk tales. Uncle Remus is the chief storyteller. He's a fictional character. He's an older black slave who tells traditional stories to a little white boy. Now, Uncle Remus not only tells the stories, he interprets them. This indicates that the stories are not standalone items, but they have to be understood in their context. These stories, as all stories are that elders tell to young'uns, these stories are vehicles for passing along knowledge, for passing along values. And in the 1880s, when these stories were published, they represented an interesting way that it would be socially acceptable for a black man to teach a white child. This was a idealized, perhaps sentimentalized, representation of plantation times. When Joel Chandler Harris first started publishing folk tales, the question of slavery had been resolved legally. Of course, however, questions of race continued to swirl much as they do today. The little boy is really a vital part of this story. He's a stand-in for the audience. He provides the impetus for the story to begin. He interrupts to ask clarifying questions, and there's some humor in his questions. And by having Uncle Remus respond to the boy, Harris has the opportunity to tell us, through Remus, the right way that we should interpret these stories, by having Uncle Remus occasionally correct the little boy's interpretation of the stories. You might find references to other characters. Miss Sally is the little boy's mother, a white woman connected to the big house, probably the wife of the owner. She's not usually present for the stories, and in fact, it's the absence of Miss Sally, the little boy's mother, that gives Uncle Remus the opportunity to tell stories. He's taking on some of the childcare roles in this society on the plantation, and this nurturing teaching of the young is something that he can do when the boy's mother is not on stage, if you will. The basic structure of an Uncle Remus story, as Joel Chandler Harris tells them, begins with a brief scene between Uncle Remus, who's a slave living in a cabin some distance from the big house, and this unnamed little boy. The boy may specifically ask for a story or some other event that reminds Uncle Remus of a story or gives him an opportunity to tell a story happens. Now, Uncle Remus is speaking in a thick dialect representing the speech patterns of African Americans in the Deep South. And these stories are all about anthropomorphic animals. These stories generally involve animals tricking each other and occasionally interacting with and occasionally besting Mr. Man. Mr. Man is the property owner in the world of the tales. So what we're looking at the work of a white editor and folklorist, a student of folklore culture, writing down the tales that he heard orally. He's writing them down for mostly a white readership. The framing narratives that describe the relationship between Uncle Remus and the child do show this idealized relationship. I mean, when slaves helped raise children, they were raising their own children at the same time. And so, you know, kids being kids, even though they grew up in a racially divided society, these kids are going to bond with the people that are around them, the people that have that care for them and meet their needs. Now, of course, if you're a slave taking care of the master's children, it is to your benefit to make sure that the kids like you. So slaves would have told stories, would have told a selection of stories to white children that would be appropriate to tell in front of the master's kids. Now, in the 1880s, there were no published versions of the real stories that former slaves told to each other. And in our class, there is little we can gain from imagining how these published tales that we have in front of us might differ from the real versions that would only have existed in oral form and might only have been called into being at that one particular moment when the opportunity arose to tell a particular story. The introduction of Nights with Uncle Remus includes an exploration of similarities between tales collected in the African American tradition and tales collected in different cultures around the world. And that suggests that these tales are ancient, ancient, ancient. I mean, either we told them to each other when humans first started telling stories, and we've been telling these same stories ever since. Or, if these stories arose independently in different cultures, then there's something about humanity that makes us want to tell stories in a similar way no matter where we are around the world, in cultures thousands of miles apart, and even thousands of years apart. The stories themselves don't add up to a coherent narrative. However, we do see Harris linking them together so that, you know, one chapter leaves off with a little hint that's picked up on again in the next chapter. So the relationship between Uncle Remus and the boy does develop a little bit across the pages, across the stories. So the relationship of Uncle Remus and the boy does develop a little bit across the stories. So we have short stories with a cast of anthropomorphic animals. After every story, basically, whether Brer Rabbit wins or Brer Fox wins, basically by the next story you have to push the reset button. They can never kill each other, one can never win totally, because you have to be able to keep telling those stories. Whatever lessons a character might learn over the course of a story, that lesson is completely forgotten by the time the next story begins. So, does this sound familiar to our cast of anthropomorphic animals competing with each other, and sometimes maybe with humans, and the central figure is a Wascally Wabbit? A Bugs Bunny is an example of a trickster. Certainly he plays tricks on other animals, including his nemesis Daffy Duck and that hunter Elmer Fudd. Sometimes Elmer Fudd only exists in order to humiliate Daffy Duck under Bugs Bunny's control. Now, I don't suggest that we can learn anything useful about Uncle Remus tales by studying Looney Tunes cartoons, and our task in this class is to study the folklore, not to study the popular culture echoes of that folklore. But I did want to point out that this whole concept of a story of animals who act like humans and play tricks on each other, that is part of an ancient genre called the trickster tale. We have examples of that in classical times, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, in Africa, in China, in numerous Native American cultures. There's a ton of scholarship on the trickster tale genre. And we can see in the way the animals are competing with each other, always in the shadow of Mr. Man, we can see echoes of how slaves might have chosen to depict power struggles in their own communities, or at least in those stories that they were most likely to tell in the vicinity of Joel Chandler Harris and, you know, and other white folklorists who first started publishing these stories. For class, we'll be discussing in some detail the first eight stories in that collection. I want to start with Mr. Fox and Miss Goose. Now, I always love to take a moment to talk about how advances in technology feature in a story. Right after the picture of Mr. Fox and Miss Goose in our iBooks text, the boy asks Uncle Remus what he means by battling clothes. And Uncle Remus explains, "These times they rubs clothes on these year bodes. What got furs in them?" Uncle Remus is talking about, you know, washing boards. That's the state of the art. Bodes is boards, a ribbed board for rubbing clothes against. He says in the old days you didn't have that fancy technology. You had to stretch clothes out and beat them with a paddle, so he calls that battling clothes. Now, Uncle Remus presents Miss Goose as a respectable woman who is not too proud to take in washing. This is a lesson for the son of the plantation owner, that little white boy who's listening to the story. This little white son of the plantation owner might grow up to be the white plantation owner. And Uncle Remus has his chance here to teach this little boy hard-working people deserve respect. Now note a couple times the boy interrupts. The boy here interrupts because he thinks it's funny that Uncle Remus has gone from talking about a goose as a goose to referring to the goose's hands. And Uncle Remus shushes him. He seems annoyed. There's an interesting little detail there. The boy is not following the rules of this story. Sometimes Miss Goose has to be an animal. Sometimes she really is a person who we're calling Miss Goose. And it's not important to the story for us actually to depict her in one form or the other. She's going to move back and forth, and the whole tales as a generality, sometimes the characters act more like animals, and sometimes they act more like people just who happen to have names of animals. But in this story, we have a predator, the fox, chasing after Miss Goose. She's not only prey, but she's female. The fox's desire, he's licking his chops at this point, the fox's desire may be more than one kind of desire, but Uncle Remus is telling this story to a little boy, so the story might emphasize a kind of desire the child understands, which is hunger. But let's imagine that there might be an older adolescent girl who might hear this same story. She might get a completely different message out of the story. Miss Goose is worried because she has no man to protect her from the advances of Brer Fox. And if you notice in the story, where does the fox go when he comes to Miss Goose's house? The first place he goes, the only place anyway that Uncle Remus tells us he went. That room in the house is significant, I think. Now, Brer Rabbit plays tricks on everyone. But in this story, he arranges things so that Mr. Dog will be around to protect Miss Goose from Mr. Fox. So to some extent, Brer Rabbit is more interested in thwarting Mr. Fox than he is in helping Miss Goose. Nevertheless, this story is an example of one of the many stories that really place Brer Fox and his antics on the side of right. Now, the next story, Brother Fox Catches Mr. Horse, is introduced with a framing narrative that suggests the little boy did not really appreciate the previous story about the fox and the goose. And Harris presents Uncle Remus as being disappointed and working hard to please this little boy. And this time he chooses a story that shows Brer Rabbit and Brer Fox in conflict over this horse. Now, there's a paragraph where it begins, "Well, atter Brer Fox done get rested." I want to go through that paragraph a little bit. There's that word slorate, S-L-O-R-A-T-E. Honestly, I have no idea what that word means, but whatever slorating means, the aggressive Brer Fox wants to do it to Brer Rabbit. He wants to slorate him. Slay? I'm not sure what the word is, but it's certainly aggressive, and in the context, we know Brer Fox wants vengeance on Brer Rabbit for the previous story. Now, another line. On top of all the speance, that's apostrophe S-B-E, apostrophe U-N-C-E, speance, that's experience. On top of all the experience that he done had with him, Brer Rabbit, he sort of get wind of this, and one day, whilst he's going along the road, studying how he's going to hold his hand with Brer Fox, I'm just kind of translating it for you as you go along, this, I'm not really sure that this hold he hand. It certainly doesn't mean hold his hand. That would be too, you know, supporting and nurturing. And I don't think it has anything to do with a hand of cards. Slaves probably would need property to gamble with, and cards I really don't think were part of slave culture. You really get them more associated with inner city vices than plantation activities. But we don't really need to worry over every phrase. Whatever slorating is, and whatever hole he hand means, the context is clear. Brer Fox is angry and wants to get back at Brer Rabbit. I mean, you know, do we have to understand everything that the Tasmanian Devil is saying to Bugs Bunny in order to understand that Bugs Bunny and the Tasmanian Devil are enemies? No, we don't. So, along with Gwan, G-W-I-N-E, going... There's that word sezzy, S-E-Z-E-E, which is says he. There's also by and by, B-I-M-E-B-Y. We'll see those often in those stories, so I'm going to repeat what they mean for us. Now, note that the horse in this story is really kind of a prop. There's a talking fox and a talking rabbit, but this horse just seems to be acting like an animal, acting like an ordinary horse, you know, the farmer's property or whatever. It doesn't seem to be a character in a folktale. The boy at the end asks whether the fox was killed, and note that Uncle Remus's reply keeps the fox around for the next story. He's very careful not to change the world too much, because the next story has to fit into this world, and these stories were not told in any kind of chronological order. Okay, story three brings in something new. Brother Rabbit and the Little Girl shows us animal characters interacting with a human girl. This is the daughter of Mr. Man. Now, Mr. Man has a garden. He owns property. He's got a fence to keep the animals out. And his law, his word is law around here. It is really not at all hard to imagine Mr. Man is a way of that the slaves could tell stories about the plantation owner. In this particular story, we read that Br'er Rabbit entertains the girl with his singing. He charms the girl, the daughter of the plantation owner, into forgetting that she's supposed to be an agent of her father's rule. She's supposed to be disciplining anybody who tries to get into the garden. There's a line there, she swayed and swayed, S-W-A-D-E, and a footnote says she's persuading. She's trying to convince Br'er Rabbit, come out and sing for me. And Br'er Rabbit is doing this on purpose. He wants to get the girl to ask him to show himself so that he can dance for her. And once he gets permission to dance, he dances all the way home. Uncle Remus points out to the boy, surely you don't spec that an old-timer would have done the spirits like Br'er Rabbit, going to stay there and let our Mr. Man sacrifice him. Shoot, Br'er Rabbit dance, but he dance home. Now, a racial reading of this story would suggest that Uncle Remus is dancing too. He's performing for a white audience. He's making himself useful as a storyteller. Now, we never see Uncle Remus doing any backbreaking work or really doing anything other than telling stories. So, was Harrison, remember he's the white editor who made money by publishing these stories that he learned in his youth from black people, is Harrison himself aware of this possible layer of meaning? I don't know. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the story, how Brother Fox was too smart, or Br'er Rabbit's astonishing prank. Let's see what you can come up with on your own for those stories. How does the relationship between the boy and Uncle Remus progress, and how do the tales that he's choosing to tell reflect that relationship? Two more questions before I end this podcast. Story number 7, Mr. Lion Hunts for Mr. Man. We don't see the usual cast of characters. Who is this Mr. Lion, and how do we, the audience, respond to the threat that he represents? What's different about Story 7? And when you look at Story 8, the story of the pigs, I think you will find that one kind of familiar, and I'm interested in hearing what your reactions are. All right, well, I hope you will enjoy reading these folk tales. They're bedtime stories. They're ways that a pre-literate culture could capture their thoughts and their hopes and their wishes and their dreams. And we only have this echo of their stories through the filter that Joel Chandler Harrison gives us. So this is Harris's representation of a fictional Uncle Remus telling a story about fictional characters. This gets to be pretty complex, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it. Okay, so happy reading, and I will see you in class.